And some of those rushing to file may be fueling up with diet soda. Americans are drinking more diet soda and other artificially sweetened drinks than in years past. And while it may seem like a good idea to cut out extra calories, researchers have found swapping real sugar drinks for zero-calorie options hasn't produced the expected results. Now, as NPR's Allison Aubrey reports, a new study sheds light on why.
Americans' love affair with diet soda has been decades in the making. Diet Coke was introduced in the early 1980s and heavily marketed. As a nation, we started drinking lots of it, along with other diet drinks. And even in the last 15 years, consumption has continued to rise. People think by drinking it, they're helping control their weight.
Well, I think they make that assumption.
Rachel Johnson is a professor of nutrition at the University of Vermont.
But what the mistake a lot of people make is that they compensate for the calories that they save in the diet soda with other foods and beverages rather than eliminating those calories from their diet.
It happens so easily. You go to the vending machine for a mid-afternoon snack, and after you push that diet soda button, you feel you've got a free pass for a bag of chips. This compensatory eating may be the reason that past studies have found that people who drink a lot of diet soda tend to gain weight over time. The weight gain also left researchers wondering if there's something about aspartame or other artificial sweeteners that primes people to want more sweet things, or in some other way makes them more susceptible to metabolic disorder, a condition characterized by excess abdominal fat, elevated blood sugar, and high blood pressure. Some research has pointed in this direction. To help shed light on the relationship between diet soda and health, researcher Kaya Duffy at UNC Chapel Hill decided to take a new approach. She says most of the prior studies had not really evaluated diet soda drinkers' overall patterns of eating.
We really did think that it was an oversight.
She wanted to know if a healthy eater who has a diet soda habit would end up better off than a person with a bad diet and a diet soda habit.
You can imagine two different kinds of people. One who orders a Big Mac and a large fry and an apple pie and a Diet Coke, and someone else who eats a grilled chicken salad and an apple and a Diet Coke.
To unravel the differences, Duffy and her colleagues studied data collected over 20 years from about 4,000 adults who had completed in-depth food frequency questionnaires, which detailed how often and in what amounts they'd eaten 100 different kinds of foods.
So it will ask something like, how often in the last 30 days did you drink low-fat milk? And then it would go on to ask about potatoes, fruit.
And of course, it asked about soda and diet sodas. Duffy explains when she compared people who were eating what she calls a prudent diet, high in fruits and vegetables and low-fat dairy, with people who were eating a standard Western diet, heavy on fried foods, fat, and sugar, she found that there were very substantial differences. The prudent eaters were significantly less likely to develop the risk factors of metabolic disorder, even if they did drink diet soda.
This kind of helps to make things a little bit more clear that it's not necessarily the diet beverage that is the problem.
Duffy says the take-home message here is that people should pay attention to their overall diet.
So what this suggests is that it's really the dietary pattern that's driving the association with health, and not the diet beverage consumption.
Duffy says an important point to note is that the absolute healthiest people in her study were those who drank no diet soda and had a prudent diet. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Audie Cornish. We're going to take some time now to talk food. We've got a new beat here at NPR focusing on the health, science, and growing of everything we eat. And with us now are the two correspondents serving up the stories behind what's on our plates, Dan Charles. Hi there, Dan.
Hi.
And Allison Aubrey. Hi, Allison.
Hi there.
So, Allison, let's start with you. What's your new beat really all about?
Well, this is really an extension of something that I've been covering for 6 or 7 years. I have looked at the science of nutrition, sort of how food works in our bodies. And what I've realized is it's really hard to answer these questions, or by virtue of trying to answer these questions, it opens up like a whole conversation about where food comes from. It gets into politics and culture and business. So it's a much broader beat, and we're hoping to look at it on all fronts.
So, Dan, what does that mean in terms of actual stories? What are you going to come up with?
Well, the first thing we should say is it's not going to be just on the radio. We have this new NPR food blog. It's called The Salt. You can find it at npr.org/salt. We contribute to it, but lots of colleagues around NPR contribute to it. It's led by our fearless leader, our editor, Allison Richards. But as far as stories on the radio, we're going to hear about palm oil, how it fell out of favor, how it's making a comeback, how that might not be such a good thing. We'll talk about salt, what happens if companies try to reduce the amount of salt in your soup. But first up, today we're actually going to talk about salad. So here's this bag of baby spinach.
Here we go.
Okay, so when you open a bag like this and eat it yourself, do you ever worry that it's going to make you sick?
Yeah, you know, a few years ago there was stuff about recalls, and that, of course, just a few days ago, Dole Foods recalled thousands of bags of pre-washed lettuce. So, yeah, I'm a little weirded out sometimes.
So does that mean we need to wash this stuff?
I wash it every time. I just don't know if it helps.
It says pre-washed, but washing might actually help, because no matter what companies do to get all bacteria always out of a bag like this, the microbes still show up every once in a while, and I wanted to find out why. So I went to a part of the country where an awful lot of these salad greens are grown. I went to the Salinas Valley in California, out to a lettuce field with a man named Will Daniels, because Will Daniels is the man who's supposed to make sure that this bag of spinach is safe to eat.
I'm the Senior Vice President of Operations and Organic Integrity with Earthbound Farm.
His company is based in San Juan Bautista, California, at the northern edge of America's great center of salad greens production. Earthbound Farm sells bags of ready-to-eat organic greens by the tens of millions. And 6 years ago, it sold some spinach that carried a deadly kind of E. coli bacteria. The spinach went all over the country. It made at least 200 people sick. 3 people died.
I was at the center of the investigation and really took it very hard. It was just a real tough time to go through and something that I don't ever want to go through again.
But making sure it never happens again, that is really hard. Consider this. We still don't know exactly what caused that spinach outbreak.
There was no clear smoking gun, if you will.
Government investigators found a bacteria that matched the microbes that were making people sick on a ranch that was one of Earthbound's suppliers. But the bacteria showed up in wild pig feces a mile from the spinach field.
And no clear indication of what caused the contamination from getting a mile away into the spinach field itself.
There's one thing the producers of leafy greens do know. Those disease-causing bacteria are out there in lots of places. For instance, they could be in the small stream bed lined with bushes and trees right beside this freshly planted lettuce field where we're standing.
Deer might be moving through here. Wild pig might be moving through here. Small rodents, rabbits, squirrels, things like that.
And where there are animals, there are animal feces, possibly with disease-causing E. coli or Salmonella. Or look across the valley at those hillsides. They're pretty. But watch out. Cattle graze there. Their manure could wash down into the fields or drain into ponds that are used to supply water for irrigation. And what if there are frogs in those irrigation ponds? They can carry disease too.
Unfortunately, it looks like every animal is a suspect.
Bob Martin is general manager of Rio Farms in King City, California. And he says, don't forget about the birds.
Birds are a big issue. They carry human pathogens, and we can't put diapers on them. We can't dome our fields. There's nothing we can do short of just trying to scare them away.
After the spinach disaster of 2006, big-time vegetable growers in California knew they had to do something. So they got together and hammered out a whole catalog of rules, ways to build a kind of antimicrobial Berlin Wall around their fields of greens. Some fields now have fences. Almost all of them, like the one Will Daniels took me to see, are surrounded by a no-man's land of bare dirt to help detect any animal traffic.
You would be able to see animal tracks coming across it pretty easily.
If tracks do show up, or animal poop, any leafy greens around that spot don't get harvested. Some food buyers say discard everything within 5 feet, others say 50 feet. Lettuce fields now have to be separated from cattle pastures, and everywhere up and down the Salinas Valley, you see white plastic pipes. Inside those pipes are mouse traps. As for the birds, well, vegetable buyers won't take anything from the area directly under power lines because birds like to sit there. But Bob Martin says even with all that, you cannot expect perfection.
When it comes to food safety, if it's grown outdoors, forget it. There's no such thing as zero tolerance. And everybody knows that, except for some food safety personnel of the big food buyers.
This is not quite the end of the story. Fresh-cut salad companies have set up a few more lines of defense. First, better washing.
You can see baby lettuce here, romaine being processed there, iceberg being processed over there.
Mark Borman, president of Taylor Farms, is showing me around one of his company's salad packing plants in Salinas, California. It feels like a giant refrigerator and smells like a swimming pool because the wash water is heavily chlorinated.
So it works just kind of like a jacuzzi whirlpool. So it kind of sucks the product under the water, tumbles it around, adds agitation.
Taylor Farms has added something new to its wash systems, some chemicals that make the chlorine work better. It still probably will not kill all the microbes on every contaminated lettuce leaf. But tests show it will keep wash water from spreading those microbes from one leaf to thousands of others. That may have happened with the poisoned spinach of 2006. That's one approach. Earthbound Farms, being organic, can't use this new wash system yet. It uses standard chlorine. But it does run an impressive testing program. It samples leaves from every bin of freshly picked greens, and it also takes samples from the washed greens that are ready to ship. Will Daniels.
It is a true test and hold program, so we have to wait until we get the negative results to put it onto a truck. Any positives go to the landfill.
And yes, every 5 weeks or so there is a positive, a sample that's contaminated with disease-causing E. coli or Salmonella. They can't test every leaf, so that probably means some contaminated lettuce or spinach is getting through. But these systems should catch a major contamination. That's what the washing and the testing are supposed to achieve. No more big nationwide outbreaks of disease because people ate that healthy salad. Dan Charles, NPR News.
Okay, so what do we do now? You're in the market, you reach for that bag of lettuce, maybe it's freshly cleaned spinach, a tightly wrapped head of iceberg, or maybe three romaine heads all in a row. Now they're toiling away in your fridge, and you want to know, what can you make tonight that will be delicious? Well, Molly Weisenberg has some ideas. She's created the award-winning food blog called Orangette, and she's on the line from KUOW in Seattle. Hey there, Molly.
Hi.
So first things first, how do we keep the lettuce that we bought with such good intentions from rotting in the fridge?
So I'm very glad to get to talk about sort of the pleasure angle of this story.
Yeah, there's pleasure to be had.
Yes. So I am as guilty as anybody else of bringing a beautiful head of lettuce home and letting it fester in the drawer. So the first thing that I always do when I bring home a head of lettuce is I go ahead and the minute I take it out of the shopping bag, I wash it, I layer it in paper towels, put it in a closed Ziploc bag, and it's ready to go whenever I want it. Easy and enjoyable for myself.
So is my salad spinner useful at all?
I think so, absolutely.
Okay, good. Okay.
I grew up using a salad spinner, and I love it.
So what kind of lettuce do you love this time of year?
So I am a big fan of bib or butter lettuce. It's great at any time of year, but particularly at this time of year, we're starting to get some that's really fresh, really delicate, these soft, velvety leaves.
And it's sort of a bright green. Usually you see it, I feel like it looks like the roots are still on the bottom or something.
Yeah, you can buy it sometimes. They call it still living.
Mm-hmm.
At some grocery stores, it comes with the root still on it. Sometimes the leaves are a little bit tinged in purple. It's really beautiful.
Well, I've got a little lettuce here, too. I don't know if you can talk about them. One of them is red leaf.
Yeah.
Which has the kind of purplish tinge.
Yeah, so red leaf is one of those that I can almost always find in the grocery store. It's got these really beautiful frilly leaves, and it's nice in particular when the heads are small. And I like to use it at this time of year in particular with all of these bright, crunchy spring vegetables we're getting, maybe some blanched asparagus, some shaved radish, maybe some chives. It makes a beautiful salad, both visually and taste-wise.
So what's a salad without the dressing? What ideas do you have for us for something to go with all this roughage?
So I think that one of the hallmarks of a really comfortable home cook is having a dressing formula that you can pull out at any time. So my dressing formula, what I almost always use, is a 1-3-5 formula. It's 1 tablespoon of Dijon mustard, 3 tablespoons vinegar of your choice, and about 5 tablespoons of olive oil. And then depending on the vinegar, you may want to scale up a little bit on the oil, maybe even up to 7 tablespoons. But basically, you're going to get this really wonderful, bright, mustardy dressing that I in particular like on these spring lettuces because I don't know who doesn't love a little bit of a little bright vinegary kick on your leafy greens, a little bit of mustard. So that's my favorite.
That's good to know. My favorite dressing usually comes purchased from the store, so I appreciate getting a recipe. All right, Molly, that was great. Thank you for talking with us.
Sure, my pleasure.
That's Molly Weisenberg, food blogger and commentator on the podcast Spilled Milk. You can find Molly's suggestions for how to prepare greens and dressings by going to NPR's food blog called The Salt. That's at npr.org. Now, as we mentioned earlier, we'll be talking more about food on this program and delving into the stories behind what we eat. And we want to hear from you. Is there a favorite family recipe you've tried to recreate, but there's always something missing? Grandma's apple pie? Your uncle's favorite chili? Well, we'd like to help you recreate your lost recipe. Molly Weisenberg gave us one of hers. She's been on the hunt for the perfect recipe from her late father, his French toast.
What I did was I took his sort of rough notes. I looked up a lot of recipes for French toast, and then I just got to work sort of blending some of them, trying to sort of dig into my taste memory and get back to the one that was closest to his. And the truth is, I don't know if what I have is exactly what he used to make, but it tastes the way I remember it tasting, and it's been incredibly satisfying for me to get back to that.
Share your lost recipe with us and a bit about the original cook. Just go to npr.org and click on Contact Us, and remember to put lost recipe in the subject line. We've lined up some kitchen detectives to help you get your family dish back on the table.